Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point. In the words attributed to Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again. It's almost time for Nevada's primary caucus, and already problems are popping up. With early voting underway, Democrats trying to cast ballots are facing long waits to do so. It's still unclear if billionaire businessman Mike Bloomberg will join Wednesday night's Democratic presidential debate in Las Vegas. And an app that caused so much trouble in Iowa's caucuses just last month is being replaced in Nevada with another app. Watching from the sidelines is President Donald Trump, who is up in the polls and who's holding a rally in Las Vegas on Friday. This hour on Point, the Nevada caucus and the week ahead in the news. And with us from Las Vegas is John Ralston. He's the founder and editor of the Nevada Independent. He's also one of the moderators of Wednesday night's Democratic presidential debate. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert.
And first, what are you seeing during this early period of voting, and what do you make of these reports of technical problems?
Well, there aren't so many technical problems as there are the long lines that you mentioned, which is causing some people, obviously, to be upset. Although it is remarkable to me, Robert, that so many people are putting out on social media and contacting us at the Independent saying, I waited in line for hours, but it was worth it. I talked to a lot of people. We discussed the candidates. So they had a mini caucus in line. As far as the technical problems, don't call it an app, Robert. They don't want anybody to call it an app anymore after they discarded what Iowa was using. They're using iPads and Google Forms. And some of the iPads have gone down, but they had a backup plan for that. And so it's all being done on paper. Almost all being done on paper. The real question, though, Robert, is all of this information of after the 4 days of early voting has to be transferred into the each precinct site for caucus day on Saturday, because, as you know, these very arcane rules with caucuses, they have to establish viability. So those votes have to be counted in viability in each of those precincts. And so, as I've been saying, there's just a lot of finger crossing going on at State Democratic Party headquarters.
So just to explain, the early voting started on Saturday, runs through Tuesday, then it's over, the early voting, and then all those results have to be fed into the actual caucus voting next Saturday.
That's correct. And there was fairly large turnout, by the way, on the first day on Saturday, Robert. I think more than anybody thought, about 18,500 people. To put it in perspective, in 2016, 80,000 people showed up on caucus day. I think that a lot of people are going to show up to vote early because it's more of a hybrid now. It's almost like voting in a primary where you can just go to a voting place and cast a ballot as opposed to having to go through the caucus procedure. And so because of what happened in Iowa, because people generally don't like the caucus, I think you're going to see a real surge in these 4 days, and we'll see what the numbers are like after that.
What issues are important to Nevadians in these caucuses?
Well, healthcare has taken center stage, mostly because of the Culinary Union, which is the biggest union in Nevada, represents about 50 to 60,000 casino workers, and the Culinary's opposition to Medicare for All, because it essentially has gotten its workers a Cadillac health plan, and there have been fears that that might be taken away. But there are also the other regular concerns that people have all across the country. Robert, the economy, which has been pretty good in Nevada, but not good for everybody, has been an issue. Immigration and immigration reform, or the lack thereof, is an issue. As you know, Robert, Iowa and New Hampshire are 90% white. Nevada has a much more diverse electorate, and the candidates have been making appeals to minorities and talking about subjects such as immigration.
Your outfit, the Nevada Independent, I gather opted not to poll, not to commission a poll for the caucuses. Was that strictly a matter of cost, or is there reasoning behind not polling in Nevada?
Well, we did do a poll a couple of months ago on the caucus, but we haven't done one recently. And believe me, I would like to do another one, Robert, but we are a nonprofit, and polling, to do it right, is very, very expensive, as you know. And I don't want to do it if I can't do it right. And it just didn't make sense for me to invest those kinds of resources in a poll. I do want to say one other thing, though, Robert. People are craving poll results. I know that. But I'm not even sure how much a good a poll right now would do because of this unprecedented early voting, the race being in such flux, and the uncertainty about all these factors about who exactly is going to turn out. A poll is only as good as a pollster can predict the turnout on caucus day and through early voting. That's very difficult to do because we're in a brave new world here in Nevada.
Yeah. You're going to be one of the moderators of a debate. It's on Wednesday evening, isn't it, in Vegas?
That's right.
And there's a big question surrounding this debate, which is, will he be there? Will Michael Bloomberg take part? I want to first play for you what Minnesota Senator and presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar said on CNN's State of the Nation on Sunday when she was sharply critical of Michael Bloomberg.
I don't think you should be able to hide behind airwaves and huge ad buys. He has to come on these shows, and I also am an advocate for him coming on the debate stage. I know I'm not going to be able to beat him on the airwaves, but I can beat him on the debate stage because I believe my argument for my candidacy is so much stronger. The Midwest isn't flyover country to me. I live there.
The implication of Klobuchar there is that somehow Bloomberg isn't interested in being on the debate stage. What actually is keeping Michael Bloomberg from the debate stage?
Well, I have to tell you, Robert, as you mentioned, I'm one of the moderators, and I still don't know if he's going to be there. I have a meeting today where I think we might learn more about that. My understanding is he has not met all the qualifications yet, which include being at a certain level in polling that is taken. I think he could still qualify before Wednesday, Robert, but the real question is,
how does he qualify? What does he have to do to qualify by that time?
I don't have all the criteria in front of me, but I believe it's three or four polls that you have to reach a certain percentage, which he will do if polling is taken. I think it might be 5%, but I'm sorry, I don't have the criteria in front of me.
National polls, not Nevada polls.
There are polls that could be, national polls or a Nevada poll would work for him. But, you know, he has no presence in Nevada, so that wouldn't even be a factor. He has not shown up here in polls. But the issue is, of course, even if he qualifies, would he show up? There's been no indication that he wants to come and debate in Nevada. I do think that Amy Klobuchar and the other candidates would love to have him up on the stage. Bernie Sanders has spent some time here in Nevada in the last few days going after Michael Bloomberg, and as you might expect Bernie Sanders would, for being a billionaire, for trying to buy the race, for stop and frisk policies that he implemented when he was mayor. They like the contrast. I think they're trying to bait him to come to the debate, but there's no indication that I've heard that he's coming.
How do you describe Nevada nowadays in terms of its blueness or redness or purpleness? Is it a pretty solidly Democratic state?
I don't know if it's solidly Democratic, but it is certainly leaning heavily Democratic. As Las Vegas has changed demographically, Clark County, which is where Las Vegas is, has become more and more Democratic. And when you have two-thirds to three-quarters of the vote in one place, and it's heavily Democratic, and the Democrats are out-registering the Republicans every week here, it is going to be very, very difficult for a Republican to win in this state. The Democrats have swept statewide and local elections the last two cycles. The Republicans don't have a U.S. senator. They have only one of the congressional seats, and they only have one statewide office. And the Democrats have near super majorities in both houses of the legislature. I think that while Donald Trump is acting like he has put Nevada in play, he's coming here this week, as a matter of fact, for 3 days, Robert, right as the caucus is going on. It's very difficult for any Republican, be it a presidential candidate, U.S. Senate candidate, a gubernatorial candidate, to win statewide in Nevada these days.
And you mentioned some of the issues that concern Nevadans, and Nevadians, I guess, is the appropriate noun.
Nevadans is fine, Robert.
Okay, good.
Well, you can call us whatever you want.
But, you know, it used to be that, especially given the very large Latino population in Nevada, that immigration was an issue that worked in favor of Democrats and against Republicans typically. Is it talked about a great deal this year?
It's talked about, considering we're a non-border state, it's probably talked about disproportionately. But that's also because, number one, there are a lot of undocumented workers here, and those kinds of debates about what benefits they should have gone on. You had a campaign for governor just in 2018 when one of the candidates talked a lot about sanctuary cities, and that still goes on here, even though there are no sanctuary cities in Nevada. And there are many Dreamers here, many DACA recipients here, including probably the most famous Dreamer in the country, Astrid Silva, who's been very outspoken and appeared at the Democratic National Convention. So it is an issue here, certainly. I wouldn't say it's the number one issue, but it's an issue.
And I'm curious about Bernie Sanders' campaign. He's the one whom the culinary workers singled out. They didn't endorse anyone, but they more or less said his ideas about Medicare for all, a single-payer national public health care system were bad and wouldn't deliver the kind of health care that culinary workers are accustomed to or to their insurance. How have they responded to Sanders' defense, which is, no, you won't pay out of pocket. You won't pay premiums. You'll pay some in taxes, but your insurance will be just as good. What's the response that you hear from people to that argument?
They don't buy it, Robert. They love what they have, mm-hmm. and you know, introducing uncertainty into something like healthcare, which affects all of Americans, and especially people with really good healthcare plans, they just don't buy it. Now, you can argue whether Bernie Sanders is mm-hmm. a strong candidate for unions or not, including the culinary, but they have been pretty adamant about this, and they could have hurt him a lot more if they endorsed Joe Biden. They did not.
We're talking about the Nevada caucus with John Ralston, founder and editor of the Nevada Independent. And when we come back, we'll discuss the 2020 campaign moving forward, plus the growing calls for Attorney General Bill Barr to resign from the Justice Department. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're discussing the Nevada caucuses and the race for the Democratic nomination for president. Candidates who didn't do so well in Iowa or New Hampshire are looking forward to Nevada, South Carolina, even Texas, and other Super Tuesday states that they say are more representative of the country. We've been talking with John Ralston, who's in Las Vegas, where he is the founder and editor of the Nevada Independent. And joining us now from Washington is Abby Livingston. She's the Washington bureau chief for the Texas Tribune. Welcome, Abby.
Hi, Robert.
And we're also joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack. Good to talk with you once again.
Hello, Robert.
Let's talk first about Bernie Sanders. John Ralston, you said you only polled once. It looks like Bernie Sanders, according to what polling there has been done, is in a strong position once again. Could come out of his third early event in a row in a strong position. And the question is, how serious is he as the front runner for the Democratic nomination? What would you say in Nevada?
Well, I think with all the caveats about a caucus and the uncertainty, Robert, I think that all of the momentum that Bernie Sanders has gathered in Iowa and New Hampshire is carrying over to Nevada. And you add to the fact that he has by far the most people on the ground here, that he did very well in 2016 here, almost beat Hillary Clinton with kind of a ragtag group of folks. And now his campaign is very well organized and being run by political pros. I think he is the favorite, but there is an all-out effort here to try to save Joe Biden and get him to finish at least second, endorsements and resources. Again, if it were a straight up primary, I would say Bernie Sanders is a prohibitive favorite. Because it's not, I still think he's the favorite, but maybe not prohibitive.
I'd like to hear from Abby and from Jack about this. Isn't Nevada supposed to be the beginning of the phase of the nominating process where diversity is much more important, where minority groups count for a lot more? And this would, in theory, be where Bernie Sanders would start to weaken a bit. Jack Beatty, that doesn't seem to be what's happening.
No, and it comes at really the an early apogee of his strength. I mean, apart from Nevada, for the first time last week in two national polls, he emerged as the front runner and won by 10 points or more over Joe Biden. That's a breakthrough. That's a big moment, and it's drawn attention to the question question relevant to all candidates of his electability. And Democratic operatives and people of the establishment are saying, well, you know, looking at his positions, is it tenable to go into the state of Pennsylvania and say, I want to ban fracking? Is it tenable, but politically viable, to go to Michigan, where, like in Nevada, you have unions with strong health plans and say, oh, end of private health insurance? Is it tenable anywhere to suggest that prisoners should vote? These are the kinds of questions that are being asked, and it thus far none of this has shown up in the polls. He's doing well, but looking at his New Hampshire results, which were good. I mean, he led, but not by much, by a whisker. And turnout was up. Turnout was even up for him. Yet Dave Wasserman of the Cook Political Report finds that most of the increase in Democratic turnout didn't come from Bernie towns, but rather from towns, almost Republican independent towns, where there were crossover votes from independents and perhaps even Republicans for Klobuchar and Buttigieg. So the Bernie theory, I'm on the ballot. I will win by bringing out a huge turnout. That wasn't borne out in New Hampshire nor in Iowa.
Abby Livingston, you report for the Texas Tribune. The Texas Democratic electorate is pretty diverse. Bernie Sanders is polling well in Texas now among Democrats.
Absolutely. So there have been a couple polls that have come out recently, including our poll, showing Bernie in first place. And when the first wave came, I was pretty surprised, because I recall in 2016, when he faced off essentially one-on-one against Hillary Clinton, she nearly defeated him by a 2-to-1 margin, 65% to 33%. And what I think Texas polling reflects is what we're seeing nationally, which is Bernie's polling 24% in Texas, which is less than what he did 4 years ago. If this bears out, you know, we have a lot of campaigning to go. But because the opposition is so fractured, he's in first with a lower percentage from 2016, when he was soundly beaten. And so there is just a fragmented opposition to him. And it does not appear anyone is on a trajectory to drop out before Super Tuesday, when so, so many delegates, including from my home state of Texas, are delivered to candidates.
Of course, what's different this time around, John Ralston, is the Bloomberg campaign. Usually, after the early rounds in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, there are people who've lost credibility with the donor class, and they haven't shown enough, and therefore their campaigns go broke. The Bloomberg campaign is not about to go broke anytime.
Well, it's nice to have your own donor class as yourself, right, Robert? Yeah. So he is going to be fine. Listen, no one's ever tried to do what he is trying to do, a billionaire essentially ignoring the first four states and then trying to do so well on Super Tuesday that suddenly he is viable. His spending is unprecedented. What he's paying people and his staff and putting on TV, nothing like this has ever happened before. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it can't happen. When you see Bernie Sanders in Nevada, as I mentioned earlier, going after Michael Bloomberg, that shows that they are taking it seriously and that Bernie Sanders is at least concerned that if he continues his momentum, which usually if he were to win the first four states or do very well in any other year, he would be a prohibitive favorite for the nomination, be very hard to stop. But if Michael Bloomberg becomes the only one to stop him, if Joe Biden does not make a comeback, if Amy Klobuchar or Mayor Pete cannot really continue surging, it's a possibility. It still seems like a long shot to me, Robert, because you're asking a Democratic electorate to vote for a former Republican mayor who implemented policies they don't like. But, you know, I guess we should never say never, right?
Right. Well, John Ralston, thanks so much for talking with us about the Nevada caucuses and much else. Good to
hear. My pleasure.
And you can join this conversation. Are you backing a particular Democratic presidential candidate? What are you hoping to see addressed during Wednesday's presidential debate? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. As we just heard from John Ralston, Bernie Sanders takes the candidacy of Michael Bloomberg pretty seriously. Bloomberg's record is under scrutiny on policies such as stop and frisk, also his personal interactions as a businessman. Politico Playbook says about Bloomberg today, he isn't on the ballot in the Nevada caucuses next week, but he is the candidate that everyone is obsessing about. And here's what Sanders said. Here's his critique of Bloomberg's record. He said this on Saturday in Las Vegas.
Regardless of how much money a multi-billionaire candidate is willing to spend on his election, we will not create the energy and excitement we need to defeat Donald Trump if that candidate pursued, advocated for, and enacted racist policies like stop and frisk, which caused communities of color in his city to live in fear.
Sanders also said Bloomberg will not generate the kind of energy needed from Democrats to beat Donald Trump in a general election. Abby Livingston, Jack Beatty, you just heard Bernie Sanders speak about racist policies. Primarily, that's a reference to stop and frisk, a practice of the New York police, which the mayor supported, Mayor Bloomberg supported when he was in office and has apologized for since. And also a recent comment or recently reported unearthed comment that a real cause of the Great Recession and the real estate crisis was the end of redlining and encouraging banks to make riskier mortgage loans. What do you make of this, Jack Beatty? Is Michael Bloomberg somewhere near what we used to speak of as the mainstream of the Democratic Party, or is he from a time before you really had to acknowledge the concerns of large minority groups to be taken seriously?
Well, I think the latter. You mentioned those two examples. There's another one. The Washington Post yesterday had a comprehensive piece of investigative journalism on the sort of prevailing sexism in his company for years and attributes to him comments that were even in 1990 would seem retro. So he's flying in the face of the Democratic Party is a majority woman party. One of the arguments against Mr. Trump is his misogyny, his treatment of women, the charges of sexual harassment and worse against him. And here's Mr. Bloomberg, nothing like as bad a record, but a record to give people pause anyway. And on the stop and frisk, you know, when you just look at the numbers, this was a mass exercise in racial profiling. 9 out of 10 people pulled over young people as young as 13 and frisked, and that there were 5 million of these stops under in the 12 years.
Over
of
12
Bloomberg.
Years, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a mass sort of event, and a federal judge found it, driven by racial profiling, and it didn't seem to yield any dramatic results. Yes, murders went down, but they've been going down, too, under Mayor de Blasio without stop and frisk, and they found only 14 guns for every 10,000 searches. That's a lot of being thrown up against the wall, as the mayor said in a statement that's been circulated. Now, throw the kids against the wall. That's a lot of throwing against the wall for a few guns.
And yet, Abby Livingston, the mayor got elected 3 times in New York, as the Bloomberg did. And there are a lot of voters who say, if he can beat Trump, I don't care. What do you hear?
I hear some of that out of Texas. I mean, the ad spending has absolutely penetrated. People who I talk to back in the state, friends, family, they're seeing it. And I guess that's my question. It does not surprise me in the least that there's suddenly a host of critical articles about Mayor Bloomberg as he's climbed in the polling. That's the natural effect of politics. What I wonder is, can he spend his way out of this with positive advertising? I don't know. We've never seen this. And so and going back to a point Senator Klobuchar made about taking questions, I started my career at the NBC Washington Bureau, and if whether or not the rules of the debate, I know that those are very controversial, but it is vitally important for a candidate to stand and take tough questions, whether it is on a debate stage or facing journalists. And I'm not just saying that because it's self-serving as a journalist, but also Tim Russert's theory was, you needed to go through the thought process of answering these hard questions and preparing. And back in the day when Russert had Meet the Press, candidates and for office spent, days preparing murder boards to in advance of his show. And it makes a better thinking process of, being the leader of the free world.
I can still remember Bill Richardson stumped on whether he had wanted to be the center fielder of the New York Yankees or the Boston Red Sox, and him fumbling that question. Well, let's hear what some of you have to say or ask about this. Susan is calling from Chicago. Hi. Susan?
I'd like to point out that I think it's really time for ranked choice voting. And the these caucuses in Nevada give people an option to, include more choices. But I think if we had ranked choice voting, people wouldn't be as terrified of making the, quote, wrong choice, and we might have had a different outcome in 2016. I think it's time to start pursuing that actively.
We heard earlier from John Ralston about the complications of trying to have caucus votes in an early voting period and then translate those into the main voting day. Would you be willing to trade off early voting for ranked voting?
Yeah, I would. If I could pick my second choice and my third choice. In fact, I read that Elizabeth Warren is many voters' second choice, and she's getting absolutely no coverage right now, which I think is unfortunate because she's got good policies, same policies as Bernie, but she actually knows how to implement them.
Okay, well, thank you.
So anyway, I think ranked choice voting would help me. Other viable candidates.
Let's turn now to Donna, who's calling from, I say Medford, but I know I really should say Medford. Hi.
Hi, this is Donna. Couple of things. First of all, I've been a Bernie supporter for 5 years, and I just think the man has such incredible integrity. And what I never hear people talking about is the fact that he can't single-handedly change our healthcare system. I mean, the Congress would have to put a bill in front of him. And if they don't do that, people seem so afraid of, the changes of the healthcare system. But
that's
anyway,
an odd,
I love
that,
him.
That's an unusual, it's an unusual argument. You're saying don't be worried about Bernie Sanders' program because he can't get it. He can't get it passed into law. So it doesn't matter.
And unless people are really convinced, and when you look at his whole plan of what he wants to do and, look on his website, I mean, I just wish people were educating themselves more, going to the various candidates' websites and really, looking at what they want to do.
Thank you for that. Jack Beatty, what do you make of that one shouldn't be too upset about Bernie Sanders' proposals, because they'll only become law if he has a landslide Democratic victory behind him for the Senate.
Yes, Bernie's staunch supporter, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, made a similar comment recently. She said, well, you know, maybe they won't be able to get the whole hog. We won't be able to get Medicare for all in the first go, but we could get the public option under the current system, under Obamacare. That might, you know, start it off. Well, of course, she was jumped on by Bernie supporters who abate nothing in their fervor for the whole hog. And you know, consider what Donna is saying. You know, Bernie would have to bear the onus of running to take health care away from 100+ million people. They have to bear that onus in the campaign without any prospect, or with dubious prospect, of it ever passing. So it's like, I see the downside. Where is electorally the upside?
And Abby Livingston, you heard the claim made on behalf of Bernie that he has integrity. I think in this case, that means he stood for the same thing all these years, which is not the way people in Congress tend to measure effectiveness. That music suggests that we'll have to get to that a little bit later. So let me just say that this is On Point, and we've been talking with Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, who joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire, and Abby Livingston, who's Washington bureau chief for the Texas Tribune. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. And earlier we heard from John Ralston in Las Vegas about the Nevada caucuses. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel. As the 2020 campaign heats up with voters now casting ballots, almost everything happening in Washington is seen through the lens of the fight for the White House. President Trump, now past impeachment, is drawing criticism from Democrats over retribution against those who testified against him and testing the limits again of his presidential power. We're joined by Texas Tribune D.C. Bureau Chief Abby Livingston and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. And before we move on to the president's post-impeachment behavior, I wanted to address one other point about the Democratic primaries and take a listen now to listener Ann, who is calling from Billings, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that very little attention has been given to Amy Klobuchar. She's experienced. She's been in the Senate for 13 years, and she's younger. She's centristic, so she can draw some of the Republicans that don't want Trump and the independents. And I don't know that we want a president that's going to be 80 years old by the time they're done being in office. So I think that more needs to be said about her, and I think she has a good opportunity there.
Well, thank you. And I'd like to raise this question with our guests about age. This is one of my bugaboos, that since 1993, when Bill Clinton was sworn in, we've had four presidents, and three of them, that is all except Barack Obama, were born within a period of about 18 months in 1946 and 1947. I'm speaking to somebody who was born within that period. My baby boom, early baby boom generation, the pig in the python demographically, just won't get out of the White House. And this year we have three men, they all are, in the Democratic primaries, who are older than we are. That is Biden, Bloomberg, and Bernie. Jack Beatty, isn't this unusual to not have front runners who are in their 50s, if not their 40s?
Yes. I mean, it's I can't go all the way back, but I would suspect it's unprecedented. And, you know, polls have shown there is resistance. I don't know that there's more than 60% of people would look kindly on a candidate over age 70, and certainly over age 75. It's something in that range, so that any of these three men running for president, you'd have to, and of course the incumbent is himself.
Yes, no, he's spring the same chicken age. And the woman he beat for office is in the same age group.
Yes, yes. What about all the talent? What about all that, you know, all those, the legions of people that could be out there? But it would be, perhaps on both sides, if it were Bloomberg or Bernie versus Trump, maybe the age issue would even out, since both would be liable to it.
Well, I'd like to move on to President Trump's behavior since his acquittal in the Senate impeachment trial, which some Republicans who all of them except Mitt Romney voted to acquit. And one of the arguments from some senators was, look, they didn't say he suffered enough already, but the implication was this has been a learning experience. The question is, Abby Livingston, what do we think he learned? What was the message of his acquittal based on what he's done and said since?
Well, I think you're alluding to Senator Susan Collins in Maine, who's going to have a very tough reelection in the next year. Given that the call to the president of Ukraine came a day after Robert Mueller testified before Congress, I think most rational people are not terribly surprised with what's happened over the last couple of weeks. The president has gone on, and there's not a lot. I mean, there's the old line from The Wire, if you're going to come at the king, you best not miss. And so that's kind of where we are. Now, Democrats are not completely powerless. They still have a majority in the U.S. House, and they still have the ability to subpoena, which is still being litigated. But Attorney General Barr is set to testify in March, and I think that is going to be an explosive hearing.
Yeah, Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana has said that President Trump probably should not have made what was a very controversial tweet about the sentencing of Roger Stone in an interview, or that is to say, Kennedy said this in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation.
This is a case where tweeting less would not cause brain damage. Look, Roger Stone is pretty good at bad decisions, and nobody would confuse him with Alexander Hamilton. Bill Barr's Justice Department prosecuted him and convicted him. While the Attorney General and others were trying to get the Senate's recommendation straight, the president tweeted, put the Attorney General in an awkward spot, and he spoke out.
Now we have, I believe it's up to 1,100 former Justice Department lawyers, or at least Justice Department employees, calling for Attorney General Barr to resign. Jack Beatty, thoughts on the Justice Department, Bill Barr, and Donald Trump?
Well, you know, Bill Barr, under his theory of the unitary executive, and this from what the law professors were saying over the weekend, Mr. Trump would be entirely within his rights asking the Justice Department to mount a criminal prosecution. In a memo that Mr. Barr sent to the president, almost a sort of job application before he got the job, he said that the president, quote, faced no legal prohibition on involving himself in criminal cases, only political constraints, of which the chief was impeachment. Well, think of that. We know now he won't be impeached if we talk about the whole culmination of impeachment, conviction by the Senate. He's got That's in his corner. So that's down. He can ask the Justice Department to investigate a political opponent, if that's what he seems to do, because Mr. Barr has said it's within his right to do it. Yeah. And the only one who could stop him is impeachment. One by one, the guardrails to autocracy are being removed in front of our eyes.
Well, I'm curious. Abby Livingston was Senator Kennedy's, I wouldn't say full-throated criticism of the president, but at least his distancing himself from that tweet and criticizing it. Is that typical of Republican opinion on the Hill, or are people mostly, have they lost the ability to be shocked by Donald Trump's actions and comments?
I think a lot of numbness has set in. What I would say with Senator Kennedy is, going forward, these Republican senators have a lot of ownership of the president's behavior if they voted to acquit him during impeachment. And so I think they're pretty all in with him. What I would also say is, on the Democratic side, this sort of confluence of the DOJ drama, the Iowa caucuses, there is a great deal of unease within the Democratic Party of, is the party going to nominate someone who can win the general election? And how that comes to be is open for debate. But if the Democrats don't win this race, the guardrails are going to be really off in a second term.
Abby, I want to ask you about something else. Congress passed a bill that was bipartisan. It wasn't veto-proof, limiting President Trump's ability to carry out military actions against Iran last week. That is, there would have to be some approval by the Congress. President Trump is expected to veto that. Would you say we should expect a veto soon?
I would anticipate that. It was a fairly narrow vote. I know my Texans sided with the president on this, Senator Cornyn and Senator Cruz.
We should explain there. You're Texans because you're from the Texas Tribune.
Yes. I have a geographic bias to them, so of interest. I think this president has total and full control of his party, and this is part of it meriting out.
The White House is not concerned about losing Republican support in that case?
I think they don't have the votes for the veto override, and so it's the Senate is the president's guardrail on almost everything.
Jack Beatty, I'm curious whether we've reached a point where, say, a petition by 1,100 former Justice Department lawyers. I have to admit, by now it just sounds routine to me. I hear it, and I've heard so many of these events when former officials have signed letters, whether it's the foreign policy community or defensive, whoever it might be. And it doesn't seem to have much effect on this administration.
Not at all. In fact, around 1,100, maybe more, former Justice Department officials, prosecutors, signed a letter about the Mueller report saying that any other citizen who showed the pattern of obstruction of justice that the president showed, those 10 different instances in the Mueller report, such a person would be liable for criminal felony indictment. That's 1,100 former officials. All that went away. Mueller was yesterday. There is this extraordinary immunity the president seems to have from what would have been in more innocent days, really just killing revelations.
In domestic matters, the president proposed a budget last week, and in an interview Saturday from Munich, Germany, at the security conference there, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi responded to the president's budget plan.
In terms of the budget, the Congress will weigh on. They've cut $10 billion. When you talk about development assistance, when you talk about climate crisis, name any subject, it's cut. And they're including CDC by 19% of their budget, which is the agency to fight the coronavirus. So it doesn't make sense. But I do believe there'll be bipartisan support, House and Senate, to get rid of most of those cuts.
Abby Livingston, if that's what Nancy Pelosi believes, do you think she has it right that there'll be bipartisan support in both houses of Congress to get rid of most of President Trump's proposed budget cuts?
I think she's right in that most presidents, when they propose their budgets, nobody really thinks it will be passed intact the way the president proposes it, no matter who it is. That's sort of Congress's territory, and they take that very seriously. So I think she has a point there. What I would say, just bigger picture, post-impeachment, all of this, and I think it manifested at the State of the Union with the iciness between the speaker and the president. There is a coldness in Washington after impeachment that's like Kavanaugh, and there was always a pass where a lawmaker would have their best friend on the other side of the aisle, and they would try to show off that friendship to show that they could rise above the partisanship of Washington. It feels very few people are even trying to put on that facade now. It is a very, very cold place right now.
You know, Jack Beatty, I'm reminded by what Abby Livingston says of a reporting trip I made to New Hampshire, to your home state, back in 2016. With a very conservative voter who, when I asked him what he thought about watching C-SPAN and seeing legislators of different parties refer to one another as a gentleman or a lady and politely respond, he found that was the very soul of fakeness, of phoniness, and really would welcome, he told me, a different atmosphere where one guy would punch the other guy in the nose, if not physically, at least verbally. And I wonder whether people in and around Washington or have been there are accustomed to a degree of civility, which is frankly not the way most people in America speak to one another, even if they're not insulting each other. I mean, it's a more old-fashioned, formal kind of address. Do we think this is a winner for Donald Trump with the public to be pugnacious and for there to be a chilled relationship with Democrats? Or do we think Americans really want more civility?
Well, polls suggest, at least, that Democrats want more civility and they want more compromise. Not so Republicans. And with Republicans, especially with the core Trump voter, his pugnacity, his vulgarity, his excess is seen as a kind of proxy for authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is saying what he thinks. He's not going through this palaver about my learned friend and all this stuff. No, he's cutting right to the quick, talking the way you talk in a bar if you're arguing with somebody. He may lie, technically, but in this way, he's being essentially truthful. I think that's the reading these people seem to have, at least judging from what one sees and reads.
President Trump has only token opposition for the nomination of his party, and he is out there campaigning. He kicked off the Daytona 500 NASCAR race in Florida on Sunday, and the president's motorcade also circled the track before the race.
The Daytona 500 is a legendary display of roaring engines, soaring spirits of the American skill, speed, and power that we've been hearing about for so many years. The tens of thousands of patriots here today have come for the fast cars and the world-class motorsports. But NASCAR fans never forget that no matter who wins the race, what matters most is God, family, and country.
Abby Livingston, the president at a sports event, but also at a cultural event, and I think making a cultural statement there.
Absolutely. And he does the sporting events very well when it comes to the theatrics of it. I believe I was at an Army-Navy game where he attended. I heard when he was at the LSU game, the place went crazy. So he really gets the theatrics of sports and the American and just riling up an arena, mm-hmm. whether it's in his own speech or at a public event that has nothing to do with politics.
I should say, on a completely different matter, also coming up this week, jury deliberations begin on Tuesday in the case of movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. The influential producer faces five counts of predatory sexual assault from six. Actually, there are two women involved. But the case against Weinstein may not end with a conviction. The case's prosecution has struggled with several victims continuing relationships with Weinstein, not just professional, but also continuing sexual relations with Weinstein. A major moment and a test of the Me Too movement will be coming to a head this week. In this hour, our look ahead, we have been hearing from Abby Livingston in Washington, D.C., where she is the Texas Tribune's D.C. bureau chief. And we've also heard from On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, who joined us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Robert.
And thank you, Abby.
Thank you, Robert.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Imada, Brittany Knotts, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sidney Wertheimer with help from Caroline Love and Bradley Noble. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.